You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of March 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Her eyes were just completely white. They were wide open, but just white and frothing at the mouth. And then the man went stiff, his arms stopped moving. Police came about 5 minutes, 10 minutes later, and then the man started throwing up.
The latest case of the mysterious yet strangely specific illness which only affects people Russia doesn't like and anyone in their immediate vicinity when it strikes. My guests Mary Dejevsky and Michael Goldfarb will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including what Italy's election means for the parties who lost it, an interesting exercise in media relations by one former Donald Trump aide, and another European country lowers the voting age to 16. Should more follow? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Mary Dejevsky, columnist with The Independent and The Guardian, and Michael Goldfarb, the author and journalist. Welcome both. It is, of course, perfectly possible that it is a complete coincidence that the two people discovered poisoned by an unknown substance in Salisbury yesterday just happened to be a former Russian intelligence officer turned British asset and his daughter. It's the kind of thing that could happen to literally anybody, a bit like somehow ingesting polonium while eating sushi on Piccadilly. Russia, as is traditional, denies everything, while UK Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson has suggested that if a connection to Moscow is demonstrated, England might well ruin everyone's enjoyment of Russia's World Cup by sending their national football team as planned. Mary, Russia, as is traditional, as we've discussed, says it had absolutely nothing to do with the attempted poisoning of Colonel Sergei Skripal. So, case closed?
Well, you have to start by saying, well, they would say that, wouldn't they? And then you say, well, actually, there's a sort of coda to that, which is that after they said that, they said, well, we would actually be interested in helping with any investigation. And this is something they certainly didn't say with the Litvinenko case, which is what this is being most closely compared to.
Do we have any kind of grasp of the straightness of their face while they made that offer?
No, but it's an offer that they made this time, whereas they didn't make it before. So you can say, well, maybe they've got more adept at diplomacy and they're better at presenting things, or maybe they are as flummoxed, at least at the moment, by what's happened as the British police appear to be.
Michael, do you find it easy to think of an explanation for this which doesn't involve Russia at some level or other?
No, it might involve, might not involve. I mean, Mary brings up this point. I mean, I tend to think that they are actually getting better at doing double reverse public lying. Mm. But, you know, I mean, who's to say, because Russia is, you know, opaque to us, it could be something that happened off books and had nothing to do with the government. It could be that the former spy in question ran afoul of other mafia gangster Russian types, and they're just carrying on because, you know, the one thing that we've learned, not just through Litvinenko, but going back more than a decade, is that the United Kingdom has become kind of the dueling ground for a lot of feuding that goes on in Russia. The city, London, is full of people, you know, families who are relocated here by people who have business interests in Moscow and perhaps fear for their safety in Moscow. And they put their families here and they send them to schools. And then things play out in this country. And that's just the way it works. But I would have to say, you know, we have to explain to listeners, this happened in Salisbury, which is, you know, it's down in the home counties. It's one of the you know, the loveliest cities.
Well, the two words happened and Salisbury don't go together very often.
I know. And you know, you have to think, Salisbury, magnificent cathedral, the retirement home of brigadier generals and former prime ministers. I mean, Ted Heath had a house there. You know, and you think, oh, come on.
How deep does this rabbit hole go?
Exactly. Well, I mean, you know, it's just, the whole thing, it really is both extraordinary but not surprising.
But one of the things that was said about Salisbury, which I'd sort of forgotten, was that he apparently did various sort of promotional work for the British intelligence services, sort of going round and explaining in his experience what the Russian military intelligence got up to. And of course, Salisbury is actually on the edge of Salisbury Plain, where the British conduct their manoeuvres. There's quite a lot of intelligence and military establishments around there, so it might have been quite a sensible place for him to live. I'd also like just to put in one of the most plausible reasons I've heard why the Kremlin might not have been involved in this, which is that, unlike Litvinenko, he was subject to the beneficiary of a spy swap. And it is said that people who benefit from spy swaps are not usually pursued by the home governments, because that would mean that subsequent spy swaps would be tarnished and people wouldn't have the element of trust which is needed at the highest level for those sort of things. So, I mean, while we're looking at this and thinking about the obvious scenarios, that to me at least prompts a slight note of hesitation.
Michael, leaving aside who might have done this, because, as you know, it is technically the case that remains an open question, what do we make of the theatrics of it? Because there are, I'm not an expert in the field, having never, you know, had anybody bumped off, but I assume if you really want to do it, there's more discreet and less attention-grabbing ways you can do it. This much like the poisoning of Litvinenko, is the kind of thing you do when you want to send a message, isn't it? You want to make a spectacle of it.
Well, I guess so. I mean, what's interesting to me, I mean, the initial reporting, and this may in the end not prove out, but the woman who was found in a similarly semi-comatose condition is his daughter, who
indeed
does not live here, and apparently had only been in country for 48 hours visiting her father, which trails a whole new set of questions behind. I think that this is clearly meant to send a message. Whoever is sending the message, and you know, the thing that I would just throw in here is we may never know who was sending the message, because the various British police forces have not been particularly good at finishing off these cases. We remember about Litvinenko, it took
8 years.
8 years and
for
a judge
to be a sort of inquest inquiry.
Inquest, as opposed to a police investigation.
Yes.
That's the difference.
Yes.
And in fact, listeners who, you know, want to tap their keyboards can go find a very interesting article from last year published in BuzzFeed, the online news website, which lists all of the suspicious deaths
cases
of Russians in this country, and how poorly the police investigated and came to conclusions that they could, A, make public, and B, you know, make sense. And I think that that's really important when you ask these speculative questions.
There's another sort of conspiratorial note to introduce there, which is that, yes, it makes it look as though the police are not terribly competent or not terribly willing to pursue these cases. But another way of looking at it is that an awful lot of them have a British intelligence aspect to it, in the sense that agents have either tried to court them and failed, or they're actually somehow beholden to British intelligence. And this is something that nobody wants to get out. So there could very well be an unwillingness to investigate terribly far or to make findings public if they're made.
Mary, just a final quick thought on this. What have you made thus far of Britain's diplomatic response? The Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson describing Russia as a malign and disruptive force. Is he wrong?
Well, I think he's at least half wrong, because what he's doing is making an enormous generalisation which feeds off the absolutely appalling relations that Britain and Russia have had really for the whole time that Putin's been in office. And there are wrong steps on both sides. But I think we also need a slight footnote to the business of the football, because the moment it had been interpreted, Boris saying that the England that it had been interpreted from what he said that England might boycott the Russia World Cup. His team were saying, no, 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 that's not what he meant at all. The team will be playing, it's just that the dignitaries won't be going.
I think if you work for Boris Johnson, the phrase "that's not what he meant at all" is one you get fairly used to uttering. Let's look now at Italy, which doesn't know much more than it did this time yesterday about who will form its next government, but does now have some pretty clear ideas about who won't. While the rival populist insurrections of Five Star and the League assert their claims upon a mandate to govern, the political establishment, as Italians understood it, looks to have been fairly comprehensively routed. Former Prime Minister Matteo Renzi has resigned as leader of the formerly governing Democratic Party, and the comeback by even more former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi has been, at best, a partial success. Michael, how comprehensive an overthrow of the status quo does it now seem, given that we've had 48 hours for the dust to settle?
Well, you know, I don't think the conventional wisdom, the punditry, has it as you've asked the question. But I'm not entirely sure. The fact that Berlusconi, at the age of 81, his party didn't do particularly well, you know, what did you expect?
Well, they did not do catastrophically. He could still be the power behind the throne of the junior partner in the governing coalition.
It's possible, but, you know, we heard these, you know, the thing about these wonderful parliamentary democracies that across the continent of Europe is that the day after elections recently, there's, except in France last the other year for the presidency, not parliamentary, you know, we heard the same thing about Alternative for Deutschland is going to be the big, the new coming party. And here we are 8 months later, and Merkel is still chancellor and will be for another 4 years.
AfD did well, though.
AfD did do well, and they can enjoy being the pleasures of being the leading opposition party for 4 years, disappointing their supporters, which is the point I'm kind of winding around to, which is, you know, I don't think the League, you can rebrand yourself, but Lega Nord, which first burst on the scene as a populist, I mean, people who equate racism with fascism would have called them a fascist party back in the early 1990s. So now they're called the League. Their original founder, whose name escapes me, has gone from the scene, and now they're led by a much younger man who may well end up as the prime minister. You know, the Five Star Movement, they've been around now for 5 years. They run Rome, and by all accounts are doing a pretty poor job at it. I think we see it as, there's all these new players. I think that there's a lot going on here that is the same. The most important takeaway for me is that the mainstream center-left party was hammered. They suffer from the same problems as the Ed Miliband Labour Party and the Hillary Clinton Democratic Party, and for that matter, you know, the Social Democrats in Germany. There is no place in the present moment across the developed world for the traditional established parties of the center-left. And they are, and there are reasons for that. Because they are led by technocrats, the elites who go to the best schools, who often come from upper middle class and beyond backgrounds, they simply don't know how to talk to people anymore. And they got hammered in Italy, and I imagine they'll get hammered everywhere they stand in elections to come over the next 12 months.
But are we about to find out, Mary, do you think, if Five Star end up in government, they are by far the biggest party, there is some suggestion in Rome that the rest of the parties might let them try to form a minority government and see how well that goes for them.
We can all imagine that.
Well, exactly. But that delineation Michael makes there between, you know, parties that know about, well, don't know how to talk to people, are we about to find out that it's perhaps not the most important thing that a politician can do? Might Italy be about to discover that it's probably more important that a party can actually run a country?
Well, I think one of the things that this reminds me so much, it's a sort of throwback to how Italy used to be before Berlusconi, that it actually managed quite well without governments, so that I don't think it's maybe quite the disaster that it seems.
I did look this up a while ago. I think before Berlusconi Berlusconi, I think including Berlusconi, they had had 65 governments, yes, since the end of the Second World War, and most of those before the Berlusconi, yes, relative stability.
Yes. So they're sort of quite used to this, and they handle it, and the country seems to trundle along regardless. So I don't think we need to worry too much about that. One thing that I thought was really interesting, when you look at the map of the results, that the Lega party did very, very well in the north, and moving down towards the south, its support is ceded to the Five Star Movement. And that suggests to me that immigration, which was big topic in this election, is actually more of an issue in the north of Rome. When you get south of Rome, the issue is quality of government and the quality of the state, and the Five Stars were attracting the objectors to the way Italy was run rather than migration
And the thing is that they were the nature of Five Star, because it was founded as a kind of anarchistic comic comment on the state of politics by a comedian, Beppe Grillo, is that it is made up of people who are of the right and of the left. Yeah. And those people on the left would traditionally have voted for a socialist, a traditional European socialist party. And they realize that they're corrupt, certainly elite. And the other thing about that map of Italy that Mary was talking about is that when the Northern League was started, Lega Nord, in the early 90s, their idea of immigrants were people from Sicily coming to Milan and Torino. So, you know, it's about, you know, othering. It's, you know, I suppose if you want to be historical, it's about the fact that Italy may be a perfectly defined geographical location from the Alps down the boot, but in fact it only became a modern state and a unified nation in 1870,
yeah,
something like,
yes,
that. And you know, and the historical fractures from the central belt, which were the papal states, and the southern bits, which part of the Kingdom of Sicily, still work their way through the DNA, the cultural and historical DNA of the society. I honestly think that it would do, you know what's going to happen? I read, this is a speculation, and he'd have to be a glutton for punishment, but Mario Draghi, who is the head of the European Central Bank, his term ends in about 8 or 9 months at the end of this year, and it'll take them 8 or 9 months to form a government, for the government to collapse, and for there to be new elections. And Draghi heading a center-left party, or just a centrist party, might end up a year from now. Who knows?
Well, that's something to look forward to. Just a final quick thought on this, Mary. Is whoever ends up running Italy going to be obliged to take a draconian line on immigration, given that that was the big topic?
Well, I think where they might start, because this was sort of the line that they also took, they might go back to European Union and Brussels and say, look what's happened in our election. This is because you didn't give us any help on quotas, burden sharing, money. And that if they could get some better deal on that, that maybe they would that they would go without some of the more draconian measures. But also, you do think that even if they introduced some draconian measures, actually implementing them, is Italy really going to be able to do that?
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Mary Dejewski and Michael Goldfarb. Coming up next, however bad your day's been, Sam Nunberg had a worse one.
Visit our online shop, where you can find items designed by our in-house team and collaborations with the brands that we love. Discover everything from luggage and clothes to stationery and back issues of the magazine, as well as our book series and popular travel guides. We deliver worldwide and offer high-quality customer service. And don't forget to let us know if you're a Monocle subscriber to enjoy your 10% discount. Go to monocle.com/shop and browse away. Or if you're in Tokyo, Singapore, Hong Kong, London, New York, or Toronto, visit us at one of our shops and we'll take care of you personally. See you around!
Yeah. You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Miller. Still with me are Mary Dejewski and Michael Goldfarb. Now, lobbying to play Sam Nunberg in the eventual film of the fall of Donald Trump has become significantly more frenzied over the last 24 hours. The former campaign aide has given a startling series of television interviews following his no less bewildering announcement that he intended to defy a grand jury subpoena requesting his cooperation in the ongoing investigation into collusion between Trump's campaign and the Kremlin. Mr. Nunberg's ebullient, media appearances prompted at least one suggestion by one of his interviewers that he might have had a few drinks, and considerable online speculation about the number of oars Mr. Nunberg had in the water. Mary, what did we watch? I mean, I guess at moments of high professional stress, as we may all have been under at some time or another, has going on cable television and giving a sequence of absolutely insane interviews ever struck you as the way forward?
Well, no, but he was obviously completely laid back, to put it mildly.
Laid and back is good. A bullient, I went with. We can have laid back.
But I think he threatened or promised to tear up his subpoena live on television. And this was a sort of contempt for the courts, which does not go down very well in America, which takes these things extremely seriously. You could possibly just about get away with it in Britain, but I don't think you could get away with it in America. He also appeared at various times to implicate Trump and other members of his team in all sorts of nefarious business, really doing the sort of downside of Robert Mueller's job for him. So, you know, it really wasn't a good day for him.
I mean, is this the beginning, or I don't even know if it's the beginning, Michael, are we just in the early stages of the flight for the lifeboats? Is that what is going on here? Because it's starting to dawn on people, is it not, that people are going to go to prison, and the quicker you sort of, I think, signal your willingness to cooperate with the investigation, the better chance you've got of sparing yourself, haven't you?
Yeah, although he was signaling his unwillingness, so
he has apparently rethought that in the last few hours.
Sobriety is a wonderful thing, Andrew.
you think he's had one of, because it is more or less lunchtime in the US, you think he had that thing where he woke up this morning and went, now hang on.
Somebody told him. I mean, it was...
Why do I have 500 missed phone calls?
Trump arrived in office trailing on his coattails an astonishing number of unfit, shyster con men. How they get... I mean, you know...
The exact phrase I have written in the script here, Michael, is idiots and grandstanders.
And idiotic grandstanders.
And grandstanding idiots.
There you go. It is... I mean, it's all part of the entertainment factor. I mean, what the world should understand is that in America, we finally crossed over into what, you know, dystopic fiction has been talking about forever, which is when media so creates our behavior that we act as if everything is a reality. TV is actually not reality, right? But they create reality TV like, I guess that's what a meme is, a reality TV meme. And that's what's been happening with this guy. You know, he's not the first. There was a guy named Carter Page who had his 15 minutes several months ago.
It's very hard to keep up.
And, you know, the thing is, I tweeted out shortly before we came on air that, you know, that 15 minutes of fame was always a metaphor, because he's been dominating Twitter for 24 hours, which is considerably more than 15 minutes. But a year from now, when the situation will have moved on, when Robert Mueller will have produced whatever indictments he's going to produce, and I still think that there's a possibility that there'll be a different person living in the White House, I think nobody will remember that this weird guy started calling MSNBC and then CNN, and then and that was after he'd spoken to the New York Times and gone on the record and was clearly drunk.
Mary, do you think we're going to see much more of what I'm going to call doing a Nunberg? I'm just wondering who you think the next candidate might be. Kellyanne Conway is today on the hook officially for having twice violated the Hatch Act by touting a Senate candidate in TV interviews in her official role, which you can't do. I mean, I'm sure the cable networks would clear their schedules if she wished to, you know, loosen up in the hospitality suite and then come on and say a few things?
No, absolutely. Though it has to be said that Kellyanne Conway is quite a practiced performer, so she might know better than to do that.
And there is an item in the New York Times today saying that she's taken two steps back because she's realised the only way to survive in the White House is to keep your head down and don't give an interview.
But I think the other thing which is really difficult to figure out where the next names, as it were, to be named, is that a lot of these people, including Nunberg, they actually faded out before Trump reached the White House. So they're not actually presidential staff. They're from before that time. And it seems that the Mueller inquiry is looking at all the preliminaries. And I think one of the things that maybe is not generally, I think it's not appreciated enough, is that Trump never dreamt that he was going to be elected president. And so all the precautions, all the professionalism that you might have taken if you'd thought you had a chance in hell of being the next president, they simply weren't taken. These guys came from a completely different world, never expected to be transformed to the White House.
Well, I for one, am still waiting for Anthony Scaramucci to announce he's running in 2020. I'm all aboard the Scaramucci the mooch train. We will look finally tonight to Malta, which has become the second EU country after Austria to extend the vote to 16-year-olds, or rather, in Malta's case, extend it to national and European elections, Maltese 16-year-olds having been able to vote in local elections since 2014. While those of us who can just about recall any opinions we held at the age of 16 might have reasonable reservations about this initiative, Maltese Prime Minister Joseph Muscat has congratulated himself and his nation on making history. Mary, I have generally throughout my life favoured raising the voting age to about 1 year below whatever I happen to be at that moment. What do you think? Do you take a more generous view?
No, I don't. I'm adamantly opposed to reducing the voting age any further. I think that if you reduce the voting age to 16, as Malta has done, then you introduce all sorts of contradictions in the law, which in a way, reducing it when it was reduced from 21 to 18, was designed to avoid. So if you set the age of majority at 18, then you have the right to vote, the right to fight for your country in combat, the right to marry, those sort of legal milestones, if you like, they're all lined up. Yep. If you start messing around with that, then you have all sorts of different things. It gets very, very complicated.
Michael, what do you think?
Well, I'm with you, Andrew. I mean, I... actually, I don't. I think I should just vote.
You're in favor of restricting the franchise to M. Goldfarb.
To me, okay. I can assure you, it would be a better world. And I'm a hard worker, people. I'm a hard worker. No, I mean, listen. I knew we were going to discuss this, and I was on the top deck of the 73 bus coming in just as high schools were letting out. And I'm telling you. Well, the trash I heard being spoken on the top deck, those kids have no right to get, no way they should get near a ballot box. It's, you know, look, the contrary, by the way, would be spoken right now in America because people are just overwhelmed by the maturity of the kids at the Florida high school.
Indeed, so.
You know, and they've been terrific. And there's a movement. It's now a nationwide movement. There's going to be a big walkout at the end of this month of high school students, big demonstrations. And I say, hey, that's great, but it's still not the same as voting across, in the way across a range of issues. And Mary, of course, is absolutely right and utterly sensible as always, because if you lower the age of majority, you have to, for voting, it brings all of these other behaviors in. And, you know, 16 in this era is just too young.
Mary, I will say in fairness that the National Youth Council of Malta did welcome this move, but then they would. They did also say it should be accompanied by increased civic education, which is hard to argue with. But this is always an argument made in favour of reducing the voting age, that you engage people in the political process earlier and therefore they are more likely to be participatory citizens in later life. Do you buy any of that?
Well, I don't really buy that because, I mean, what we've seen is a pathetic turnout among 18-pluses. And if they can't get out to vote, what's to think that the 16-year-olds are going to do any better? And, you know, there'll be... I mean, it has to be said that sitting here, we are, as it were, of a certain age. We're not really lobbying for the 16-year-olds. But one of the most specious arguments I hear in favour of reducing the voting age is the one that was made in Scotland and was made before the Europe referendum in the UK, which is, well, it's their future. They should be voting. All elections are about the future.
Well, we don't have time, unfortunately, to discuss my proposal of also restricting voting or banning people 1 year older than me at any given moment from the vote. That does bring us to the end of today's show. Mary Dejewski and Michael Goldfarb, thanks for joining us at Midori House. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Pierre-Antoine Denis. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. Music next at 1900 at Section D. More on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thank you for listening. Thank you.